Good evening. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, a monthly K2 radio show that explores issues of the heart as well as the mind. We'll be on the air for about an hour this evening with one or two short musical breaks. There's been quite a bit of controversy lately about criminal justice reform, as well as recidivism rates. By that, I mean the proportion of former prison inmates who would reoffend and return to jail. In fact, over the past year, I've had several guests on the show who have talked about this issue, topics from therapeutic courts to Haven House, which is a residential reentry program for women in Juneau. And not too long ago, I had the good fortune to interview the former Commissioner of Corrections, Dean Williams, just before the election that cost him his job. On that show, we discussed the Norwegian prison model, which emphasizes rehabilitation over harsh punishment. And we looked at the data that shows that there is a lower recidivism rate for programs modeled after Norway's, even the system in Texas. Commissioner Williams had instituted several outreach and job training programs at Lemon Creek and in prisons around the state. So tonight, we're going to focus on a longstanding and successful education program at Lemon Creek Correctional Center. My guest tonight is Dr. Saul Neely, professor of English at UAS and the founder of a prison program called Flying University. Welcome, Dr. Neely.
Thanks, Elaine. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. Well, let's first of all explain what the Flying University is briefly, and then I want to get your background on what led you to do that program.
Okay. Sure.
Just define it for the folks.
Sure. The Flying University is a prison education program that I started in fall 2012 that brings university students inside the prison for mutual and collaborative study. That's an important feature of what we do because when I bring outside students into the prison, we're not there to study or to research or even to help incarcerated students. We're there for mutual and collaborative learning. And a lot of the outside students that I bring in really have that revelation that there is a great deal of wisdom and knowledge that's locked up inside of our prisons that if articulated and gets out and is respected, you find a lot of source for community healing locked inside the prison.
Wonderful, wonderful. Saul, what led up to you teaching at UAS and then creating the Flying University? Because as I understand it, your whole interest in prisons and reimagining prisons and the justice system began well before you came to UAS. And you came to UAS how long ago?
I arrived at UAS in fall 2009.
Okay. So what led up to the Flying University?
Well, it's a good question that has some sort of deep roots in my own life, and it's nice to have an hour to sort of unpack these things. I graduated high school in Georgia in 1991, and I lived in Georgia at the height of the war on drugs. It was a brutal police state. It was just crazy. We had roadblocks from 4:30 p.m. Friday afternoon to 4:30 a.m. Sunday morning. They would move these randomly around the community every half hour. Just a total violation of Fourth Amendment rights. We used to talk about the 1/4 Amendment rights. I was right after I graduated high school, all of our local community police departments became heavily militarized. That's when they started wearing the black fatigues instead of the old-fashioned sort of cop uniform with the button-up shirt and the nice fancy hat. You know, they're wearing fatigues on the street. Cop cars became black. The windows were tinted so black you couldn't see through them. I remember the Georgia State Troopers, I believe, had a couple of Dodge Vipers V12 engines, all painted black, just really scary, super muscular police vehicles. And they all said on them, painted by money seized from drug raids with a big marijuana leaf painted on the side of the car with that red circle and slash through it. Drug laws were crazy at that time. This was a time when the Grateful Dead, for instance, was still touring. I remember I got tickets to go see the Grateful Dead. And when I bought the tickets, I was also given a warning about LSD and the way that the cops were policing it, you know. So, like, you know, you could get a Teddy Graham, you know, these little graham cracker, you know, treats. And people might put a drop of LSD on it, but it didn't matter it didn't matter how potent the LSD was. It was what carried it, that and the weight of what carried it, that would determine your, if you were busted, it would determine your sentencing. So just completely irrational, illogical. And I had a lot of friends go to prison. I had friends go to boot camp. At that time, Zell Miller was the governor of Georgia, and he made all these boot camps for drug offenders, and people were literally going to prison for a joint.
For consuming, not dealing?
Yeah, exactly. Just for consuming. It was wretched. Fortunately, when I was 22 years old, my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, she moved to Alaska, and she came back 7 months later and said, "You need to come to Alaska with me." I was like, "I'm ready. I'm done. I'm done with the Deep South. I'm done with this police state. I'm done with being paranoid all the time. I'm done with the PTSD of every time I see a cop pass
yep.
me." I was young. I used to drive this Volkswagen Beetle that had question authority stickers on it and stuff like that. I've been pulled over for avoiding a roadblock. I don't need to detail all the potential moments where I could have gone to prison in my early 20s as well. But that's a significant feature, or just a significant reason. I feel overwhelmingly lucky that I myself never ended up arrested or in jail or in prison.
Because you were in Georgia and you were white, would you say that skin color played a part in your luck?
Absolutely. There's a lot of privilege embedded in the drug war, of course. I moved to Alaska in 1996, and you think about Newt Gingrich in the sort of Republican revolution of 1994, and you think about all of the policies, all the political fear that they were stoking at that time. And look where they're at now. I mean, there's a total prison crisis in the state of Georgia.
In what sense?
Well, there's too many criminals. It costs them too much. You know, they can't have this sort of conservative fiscal responsibility with this out of control prison system that costs so much money. And so you bring people into the prison system, and it just creates it manufactures criminality. And the state of Georgia got into a pretty precarious position where they couldn't afford their prisons. They couldn't afford that approach to the criminal justice system. So they had to start releasing, you know, people. And you're releasing people out of segregation. You're releasing them after, 10, 15 years of incarceration with so-called tough on crime initiatives that don't give them any sense of correction, any sense of rehabilitation. It's just pure, blatant revenge and punishment, all of which, especially in the South, racially motivated.
Yeah.
It's a complete disaster. And it's a little bit scary that we're seeing that come to Alaska right now.
Yes. I was just having a little rapid heartbeat there, thinking that is perhaps the new policy is to lock them up more. And the war on criminals rather than on crime, mm-hmm. and even a mention of privatizing prisons. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, is going the way, it sounds like, of everything that has been shown to increase crime
right.
rather
That's
than
right.
decrease it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. It's blind ideology. There's, mm-hmm. there's no data. There's no evidence that the tough on crime rhetoric does anything but destroy our communities and produce higher rates of criminality.
But isn't the evidence quite the opposite?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It is. That's right.
That a rehabilitation model has lower recidivism
mm-hmm.
than a, what term you're using, revenge and punishment. I mm-hmm. just said harsh punishment.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. We saw that in that documentary, Breaking the Cycle.
For our listeners out there, Sal just watched a documentary that Commissioner Williams recommended on our program, and it's really good. And you could get it on YouTube, I think, and mm-hmm. it's called Breaking the Cycle. And it's a comparison of the Norwegian prison philosophy in actuality with U.S. prisons.
Attica.
And Attica. It was Attica. Mm-hmm. And when you watch that film, you are not surprised that former Commissioner Williams was greatly moved by it to really try to reform our prison system.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
From the inside out.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So continue. So there you are in Georgia.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You're about to move to Alaska.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And I moved to Alaska, and it was sort of a tough moment in my life. I didn't have a lot of resources for pursuing college. And so when I was 24 years old, my wife and I were living in Homer, Alaska, and we just living in cabins and sort of, you know, reading books and doing our own sort of philosophy. And but when I turned 24, I got back into school right away. I started first year in Homer, then we moved to Anchorage. I finished my bachelor's degree in English and philosophy, did my master's degree in English with a focus on literary theory. And then I went to Purdue University for 5 years to get my PhD in their philosophy and literature interdisciplinary program. And while I was at Purdue University, I sought out an opportunity to teach in prisons. And I discovered that Indiana State University had a program they called the Corrections Education Program, CEP. And it was, I think, about half a dozen different prisons in the state of Indiana hosted this program, and inmates could get an associate's degree.
Wow.
And it was really cool. I taught in two prisons in particular, and one of them right outside of Greenville, Indiana, it had a particular impact on me. But, you know, I would clear security, walk through the yard, this old, old brick, you know, mm-hmm. Prison from, you know, I think the late part of the 19th century or something. It just felt really old. They called it the State Farm. But they had a school building, and you'd clear the lobby, and there were maybe a dozen classrooms. And at any one night, they were teaching I taught writing, mm-hmm. but they were teaching history. They were teaching accounting. They were teaching math. And these inmates were getting their associate's degree. And that was a really incredible experience. And I knew when I finished my PhD and I got the job here at UAS in Juneau, I wanted to continue teaching in the prisons. And it took me a few years to get acquainted and networked in this community to the point where the opportunity availed itself. But somebody connected me with Paul McCarthy, the education director at Lemon Creek Correctional Center, and it's been a hit ever since.
So how long ago was that?
That was fall 2012, the first time I brought university students inside the prison.
And let's hear about the program. Describe your program there.
Yeah, it's loosely modeled after a program I became acquainted with called the Inside Out Prison Exchange Program. That program began at Temple University, but I became familiar with it through the work of Dr. Steve Shankman at the University of Oregon, who incidentally I'm going to bring to Juneau in April. And what I loved about the Inside Out Prison Exchange Program was that they brought university students inside the prison. So it's not just me as a professor going
in. Oh, that's where the Inside Out name comes from. And
yes.
So you followed that model.
Exactly. I followed that model. Steve Shankman invited me to take the training at University of Oregon. It's a summertime training deal, but I couldn't muster the resources at the time.
Training?
It just trains you how to teach in that program.
Oh.
And so the protocol and pedagogical techniques and these kinds of things.
Yeah.
It's a little bit prescriptive, which I don't have when I use the word prescriptive, it's a bad word. But
no, it's very helpful. So you don't have to learn from your own mistakes as much.
That's right.
I mean, that's
exactly.
The big one.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so that's the model I wanted to build. And in fall 2012, I taught a class at UAS called Fugitive Thought, Philosophy and Literature Born of the Prison. And then at the same time, I was teaching my parallel class inside Lemon Creek. So I was teaching a class inside Lemon Creek, a class at UAS. In the last 3 weeks of that semester, I brought the students together. So the first integrated class we had that first semester was only 3 weeks long.
Wow.
But the following semester, we did a 6-week integrated program. And then after that, it's been 10, 11, sometimes even 12 weeks.
So then the UAS students go into the prison. And so that part of their class, they get credit for.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I designed an honors program at UAS in this era of austerity and budget concerns. The honors program was suspended this past year, but I'm hoping that we can bring it back. I actually have an appointment with my provost this week to talk about bringing it back. But one of the features of the honors program was a sustained community engagement endeavor. And so some of the students who graduated through the honors program fulfilled that requirement by participating in Flying University. Other students would take it as part of a class with me, and then they part of the course requirements would be fulfilled by the prison experience. And then other students just volunteer. They're just interested in the experience. They're not necessarily interested in college credit or anything other than the experience. And so there's a variety of reasons why we bring outside students inside the prison. But it's been...
So variety of reasons. Could you give us some of the reasons that... You mean what kind of benefits are there for your students at the university to go inside the prison?
Well, it's really interesting because sometimes I learn about the personal motivation that guides a student. I don't always hear about it up front. Mm-hmm. I can be pretty open about one student in particular because he's been open about this, and he was our student commencement speaker last year at UAS, Blake Fletcher. Actually, he was on a Geno afternoon with me one week. But he has a really incredible story. His father was incarcerated when he was a kid.
There you go.
And we had gone in. He tells the story. It's his story, but I'll try to rephrase a little bit of it real quick. But he tells this really incredible story about being inside the prison 1 week. And one of the other inmates who was in the class, just awesome guy, but big, huge. Like I used to jokingly say, his hands were like baseball mitts. and he would say he asked Blake, so what are you doing this for? And Blake told him about his dad, and the inside student said, well, let me ask you this: did you hate your dad? And it was just this big moment where Blake was like, no, of course I didn't hate my dad. I love my dad. And the inside student was like, that's tight. That's tight. Because he's a dad.
Of course.
And he worries.
And he wanted to know, will my son hate me?
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. And so, sometimes I get students who've never been inside of a prison. And they just show up and they're totally transformed by the experience. When you can get past the fear and you can relate to people as human beings, and that relation is predicated on respect and not skepticism, but a respect for the dignity of the other human being. And,
anytime we have a close connection with the other, whatever the other is, people of different races, people of different social classes. For me, the revelation was living 2 years in a poor Indian village, a village in India, as a Peace Corps volunteer. And that's changed me forever, forever. Mm-hmm. Because when you spend a lot of time with people who you normally would feel incredibly distant from. I mean, you'd think, oh, the man in the moon. You know, let's say you're in the Seattle airport and you see this old, dark-skinned couple. She's in a sari. He's in salwar kameez. And you'd think to yourself, they're like from the moon. I mean, I can't relate to them. And, of course, the same would be for prisoners. Somebody who's been in jail, if you've never had any family or experience with that, or it could be for people, gay people, if you've never met a gay person. So it is, I think it's an absolutely transforming experience that to your students from UAS opens their hearts greatly. And it's just really good for their whole lives to know, you know, if they get to really feel. I watched the K2 documentary that you recommended, and you can go online and just type in Flying University, and there's a 40-minute, maybe 36, 22-minute documentary made by Scott Burton of K2. And just watching some of the people in there. And as I understand, Saul, maybe some people at Lemon Creek are listening into the program tonight.
Yeah, that's right.
Because here's what I'd like to say. For the gentleman with the pigtails, I just thought you did a really good job with the Shakespeare play. So,
that's right.
You know, you
it's
should
LC.
Try theater. You know, you could have a theater company. The Perseverance, you go into the prison. Oh,
right.
No, it was very, very heartwarming. Even just that short documentary opened my heart up. So it's really good for students.
That documentary was shot when we were teaching Shakespeare. And my colleague, Robin Walls from UAS, he's a professor of history, he has made the argument over and over again that students can study Shakespeare, but it's so radically different to study Shakespeare in the prison. And, you know, if I could tell a quick story about about that that semester and during the day we were filming that documentary, actually, I can't remember her last name, but Perseverance Theater was putting on Othello. And Kat, who played Desdemona, she came into the prison that with the day that the documentary was being filmed. And then the guy who played Othello came in the following week. And we had one of the inside students who was in the documentary, a 64-year-old African-American man who'd been a Vietnam vet, and his first marriage was an interracial marriage. And he said, "I am Othello. I have lived Othello's life." And that day that we were filming the documentary, we were doing our breakout group conversations, and Kat, who was playing Desdemona, and Mr. Alexander, the inside student who identified as Othello, and myself and a couple other outside students, we were having this incredible conversation. And Mr. Alexander just went into some really deep kind of psychological insight about what motivates Othello. And he just kind of blew Kat's mind. And we left the prison, as we usually do, about 3:30 p.m., and we're walking out the gate into the parking lot, and I turned to Kat and I said, "How the hell are you going to go on stage now? You've got to be on stage in 3.5 hours. And your mind has just been blown about everything that motivates Othello." You know? And it was incredible. It was incredible to get that kind of insight.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's great. So what classes are being taught now, for example, or this year, this academic year? What do you teach in the prison?
Last semester, fall, I taught Native American Lit, and we called it, I think the official title was Story and Society Through Indigenous Inspirations. And that was a great class because we ended with Ernestine Hayes, who came in on our last class. On the last class of every semester, we hand out certificates of completion. The prison administration allows me to bring in prepackaged food from Costco. So we get to have our own little banquet, and we pass out our certificates, and we have celebration. And a couple of guys sang some songs. One of our guys wrote a beautiful hip-hop song It's a one-time deal. We weren't able to record it. You know, I got the lyrics. He wrote them down. He gave them to me. But that moment in the prison when we played an instrumental hip-hop track, and then he just sort of rapped over that, and it was a hip-hop song for the Flying University, and he name-dropped everybody we read. He name-dropped participants. It was amazing.
Wow.
And then another inmate, Muffin, he wrote a beautiful song that almost brought tears to our eyes. That day also, Ernestine told a little bit about her story, and it just, you know, drew so much respect from the guys inside. I remember when Ernestine was done a little bit talking about her story, one of the inmates asked, there were tears.
Yeah.
Let's just be honest about that. There were tears. And, you know, what a magical moment, though. You know, I mean, what a just a magical kind of utopian pedagogical moment where in the middle of the prison, you can have tears as a response to human commitment and human dignity. And when one guy asked if he could give Ernestine a hug, and she gave him a hug and, you know, an embrace that lasted for a few seconds, and you could just kind of feel or hear, you know, the inmate just breathing, just releasing that breath, you know. And then another inmate asked, can I have a hug? And Ernestine gave him a hug. And then she said, has anybody else wanted a hug? And another guy got up, you know. But yeah, it was just a really, really special moment that day in class. And then this semester, we're starting up next week with this semester's seminar. And it's going to be on philosophy of community.
Philosophy of community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is philosophy of community?
Well, we are going to start by talking about, I'm going to introduce the work of a guy named René Girard. He's a French anthropologist of religion. He taught at Stanford a lot. He is one of the Académie Française immortals, one of their great immortals.
Yes, he is.
One of his most prominent students, Sandra Goodhart, was my dissertation director. So I lay claim to René Girard as my pedagogical grandfather.
You do?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I met Girard at the MLA conference when they gave him a Lifetime Achievement Award. Yeah.
Yeah.
He passed away a few years ago, but but his work is incredible, and it's all about, he calls it the mimetic hypothesis, but it's the most sort of sophisticated philosophy of scapegoating, how scapegoating typically it's the mechanism by which community is so frequently brought together. At the heart of so much political identity is scapegoating.
Could you mm-hmm. Define state building?
Scapegoating?
I think of it as nation building. Do you mean state building? What is that?
Oh,
what does it mean?
There are so many economies of scapegoating and economies of abjection that are at work anywhere from the personal level through a group of high school friends to a community, to a city, a metropolitan area, a national region, the state, or, you know.
You mean any group one identifies with, or?
Yeah. So this is the way I introduce it to my students is I say, I begin by the body, right? I begin at the level of the body, our own personal identity. When we look in the mirror and we see an image of wholeness reflected back to us, we so desperately want to identify with that image. And this is something, you know, Jacques Lacan talks about in the mirror stage, and it's a sort of a key mm-hmm. insight to psychoanalytic theory, mm-hmm. right? But when we identify with that image of wholeness reflected back to us, what we're not identifying with and what we're suppressing and forgetting as an integral part of our identity is the shit in our intestines, right? The blood, the pus, we sweat, you know, all of
mm-hmm.
this.
Yeah.
This is what we want to forget. We want to deodorize it. We want to manicure it. We want to forget that that's an integral part of our own body.
Mm-hmm.
Well, communities do this as well. You know, we have the social abject, right? We have populations that we scapegoat in order to found a political identity
for
that community.
Oh, so it's like U.S. exceptionalism.
Yes.
And then demonizing, creating the propaganda to demonize the enemy, which would be people of color.
Yes.
Gay people, felons.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
So scapegoating, so Girard's real insight here is that scapegoating works when we don't know it's working. So,
yeah.
So let me, I'll say this real quick. So he was a Catholic. Girard was Catholic, so he was Christian. And what Girard noticed is that we get caught up in economies of violence around the scapegoat, and it has a impact on us. It has an effect on us when we don't realize it's working. If we expose it, if we reveal it at work,
yeah,
then we demystify it and it ceases to have an allure,
right,
and a hold on us.
Right.
And so as a Christian in his early days, Girard made the argument that what was unique about Christianity amongst all the world religions was that for the first time we know with Jesus, the passion of the Christ, is that Jesus was innocent. And that's key. The scapegoat is always innocent as a scapegoat. And what we mean by scapegoat is the origin of violence. Where do we discover, where do we discern the origin of violence in our communities?
Crux.
And it's the scapegoat who is identified as
course.
The origin of violence. Now, Girard changes his thesis. I feel like I need to say that because my teacher, Sandra Goodhart, was Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And as one of Girard's most prominent students, Sandra Goodhart revealed to Girard, no, look, the anti-sacrificial, the anti-scapegoating features of Christianity are just developed from what's already there in Judaism. And then there was a book recently published about Girard and world religion. So, you know, they're discovering in all sorts of arenas that there are, in fact, you know, so many world cultures, so many world religions that also have an anti-scapegoating, anti-sacrificial aspect of cultural belonging. And I'm interested, you know, like in indigenous oral literary traditions, for instance, you know, that can reveal that as well.
Have you found any anti-scapegoating themes in indigenous literature, let's specifically say Southeast Alaskan, Tlingit Oratory, the books the Downhauers translated, the material the mm-hmm. Downhauers translated?
Absolutely. I think it's all there. I think oral literary tradition and the way it's grounded in protocol is an expression of sovereignty. Ceremony is an expression of jurisdiction. The irreducible and foundational demand for respect, I think, is so key there. I mean, Western philosophical traditions after Rene Descartes, all the scientific methodology, positivism and all of this, it's all predicated on skepticism. You
mm-hmm.
know, but if you can think instead, like, you know, I've heard David Katzik talk about Tlingit science. You know, Western's positivistic science is based off skepticism, but David Katzik will talk about Tlingit science is grounded in respect. And incidentally, I've seen David Katzik go into the prison and address, you know, an assembly of inmates, and he begins by calling them beautiful and precious individuals.
Mm.
I mean, what a radical gesture that is.
Yeah.
And when we think about the scapegoat, as the origin of violence, this is the problem. We absolutely scapegoat our incarcerated people, right? Because the key here, the key insight.
Oh, it's going on right now.
Exactly. The key insight.
The war on criminals.
It is. The war on criminals, right? The war on criminals is
to change that terminology.
People. Yeah.
And change it from the war on crime, which I think is in a way bad enough
mm-hmm.
because of the violence associated, the war on crime,
mm-hmm.
and the lack of understanding of where crime comes from, and then transforming it deliberately to the war on criminals
yeah.
is really a philosophical statement.
It's classic scapegoating. And okay, two things I made real quick. One, Girard realized that the scapegoat is always substitutable. So whether it's, you know, gay people or it's immigrants or it's Muslim people or it's
yeah.
criminals, it's always substitutable.
Or Hutus or Tutsis.
You're right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, with regard to our prison system, you know, the overwhelming majority of people incarcerated in our prisons come from poverty. They come from transgenerational trauma. They come from issues of recovery and addiction, a lot of which was manufactured in part by pharmaceutical companies, you know?
Right.
So
without regulation.
Exactly. And they are dubbed the origin of violence. But they're not the origin of violence. They're an expression. They're an extension.
They're a symptom.
Exactly. Of a prior economy of violence, you know, that is caught up in our capitalistic political economy.
Right. Well, the violence of unequal distribution of the wealth and the severe violence of that's coming up more and more as I watch the statistics. Do you know the Gini coefficient, which measures the degree of concentration of wealth in a population where a few of the richest people can own 30% of all the wealth in a country or 50% of all the wealth when you have an oligarchy like we have now.
Right.
And the relationship between that and the increased number of street people, you know, suddenly – and the increase in crime and a lot of crime due to looking for drugs,
mm-hmm.
break-ins due to looking for drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So then, you know, it seems like mysterious. All of a sudden, why in Juneau are so many people sleeping in the doorways of downtown businesses where that wasn't going on 20 years ago or 40 years ago when I moved here? Well, take a look at the distribution of wealth. There was more of a middle class. There may have been, I'm not sure about this, a bigger safety net, but we're really slashing the safety net and being the only country, developed country in the world that doesn't have health care for all.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There's absolutely no shortage of wealth. I mean, it's
right.
It's remarkable to me. I mean, whether, you know, Dunleavy wants to cut $20 million from the K-12 budget, at least, wants to cut the prison programs in whatever way he can, wants to inaugurate a new era of austerity in our university system. It's ridiculous. There's no shortage of money in this community, in this state, in this nation, in this world. It's just concentrated into the hands of a few people. And everywhere we're told, budget crisis.
And people believe it.
Yeah.
That's what's really sad.
Yeah.
This is the perfect time, Saul, to take a short musical break. So we're going to do that, and then Dr. Saul Neely and I will be back to talk some more about the Flying University at Lemon Creek Prison and the possibility of reimagining how we see justice. So we'll be right back. Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio tonight is Dr. Saul Neely, a professor of English at University of Alaska Southeast, who founded the Flying University at Lemon Creek Prison. And we have just been talking about all things philosophical, and we even are relating it to the topic of the evening about the educational program that he founded and is running at Lemon Creek. So let's go back to a little bit about your feeling, Saul, about what former inmates need when they get out of prison and how Flying University fits into that.
Okay, that is a good question, and there's a couple of different ways of approaching, I think, the answer. One is to deal with the concrete exigencies of what we deal with. And so in that term, in those terms, what I can say is that our communities don't yet have the resources, or they haven't mustered the resources and the kind of way that they need to reduce recidivism and to help people successfully reenter, right? So we have the 70% recidivism rate, but we still have problems with access to mental health issues, recovery issues, good housing, good employment. We have all the prejudices. We have all the scapegoating that we were just talking about. And in that context, it's really hard. What makes Flying University different than the Inside-Out Prison Exchange Program that we were talking about earlier is that we have become a reentry effort. With the Inside-Out Prison Exchange Program, once the seminar or the semester is over, outside students are prohibited from having any contact with the inside students. But in our little community, you can't do that. You know, we go into the...
You mean contact? You mean they're not allowed to go back into the prison? Or have contact once the prisoner is released?
Both, as I understand.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, with the Flying University, I think it was after the second semester and then the third semester, we had one formerly incarcerated student got out. He came to UAS, and he was immediately received by a group of outside students that had been inside the prison with him.
Who knew him?
So they welcomed him.
Yeah.
And they welcomed him. He showed up. They said, hey, come to the poetry reading with us. He went to the poetry reading at the Poetry Slam, the Wishkin Ayedi Poetry Slam, and he won.
Uh-huh.
And then he ended up going to the Grand Slam that year and won. And and he's working on a MPA degree right now. Now he's working on his master's degree.
At UAS?
Yeah, yeah.
A Master's of Public Affairs?
Yeah.
Oh, that is, I just have goosebumps. That's a fact. And public affairs.
Right, exactly.
Oh, that is incredible.
Yeah. And he's the second of our formerly incarcerated Flying University students. The other one is finishing up an MPA degree as well through UAS. He just moved to California. He's going to finish it up by remote.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know, we have become a reentry effort, and I'm really trying to do the best that I can to make those resources available. In fact, I was just approached by Shauna O'Sullivan and Jesse Post from UAS. They work with the Alumni Association and with the UA Foundation. And Shauna O'Sullivan stopped by my office one day just to chat about the Flying University. And she said, you know, we can use our 501c3 status here to create a fund for you. Because I told her I want to develop funds. I want to develop scholarships because for the past two semesters inside Lemon Creek, I've been able to offer incarcerated students college credit. So last semester, it was for writing 111. Five guys
really?
Got, yes.
You're giving college credit now?
College credit now, yes.
Oh, because in the video, the documentary, that you said that was your great hope.
That's what I end on. I know, exactly. And the semester before that, we had four students who received Philosophy 201 college credit. So there are two guys inside Lemon Creek right now who will probably get out in 2 or 3 years, and they've already got two GERs toward a college degree, completed and debt-free.
General educational requirements.
Exactly. And that's the thing. I cannot ethically get any of the incarcerated students into debt for college credit. That's just – that's ethically
– So how do they afford – get the credit? Is it free?
No. So it's by the generosity of our community members. So KJ and Peggy Metcalf, I have to give a shout-out to them.
Absolutely.
They have sponsored scholarships. At this point, we got some local players who are helping me develop this fund. Ricky Annalino, Christina Love, Talia Ames from Second Chance Program. You know, we're building a scholarship fund that people can donate to. And as we develop this fund, I'm hoping to both get incarcerated students college credit to pay for those college credits so they don't go into debt. Mm-hmm. And then also, if they get out and they think they want to try UAS, we're going to help them out for the first year in whatever ways we can. If it's paying for a class, helping out with housing, paying for some books, that way they can give it a try. College mm-hmm. isn't for everybody, but
right.
It's really unfortunate that so many incarcerated people just think it's not for them. And so they come out, they give it a try, and if they like it, then they can sign up their, you know, they can fill out their FAFSA forms, and then they can, you know, decide to take out student loans and this kind of thing if they want to. So that's one answer to your question about the role of Flying University
yeah.
and reentry and trying to reduce recidivism. But the other bigger, side of that question is, we as a community have to fundamentally rethink what we think about how we conceive of justice. And, you know, we were talking about the distribution of wealth and the concentration of wealth earlier on. We have the political, we have the material and the rational means to end poverty, right? We have the material and we have the material and the technological means to end poverty, to end homelessness, right? To end the cycle of 70% mm-hmm. recidivism rate. But what we don't yet have is the rational means for doing that. And if we can develop that, the rational means, and in order to develop that, we have to step up and become a little bit more courageous. So on March 5th, for instance, Tuesday, March 5th, from 7 to 8 p.m. at UAS with the UAS Alumni Association, I'm going to host a talk about Flying University. We're going to use this as a way to help announce the scholarship fund and to help, you know, to solicit donations and whatnot. But we're titling that event the Courage for Community because if we want a rich, healthy, multicultural community, it has to be predicated on courage. It can't be predicated on fear and scapegoating.
Yes.
And so if, you know, one area that I'm really interested in is critical utopian studies. I've taught a utopian studies class in the prison. And one of the things I'll have my students do, a project I'll have my students do, is imagine that they are tasked with abolishing the prison industrial complex. I mean, I identify as a prison abolitionist. And so I make them work together in groups. You've got to get rid of the prison system. What are you going to do with the people who are incarcerated? And it's brilliant mm-hmm. because that's when the students begin to boldly imagine, well, okay, we're going to need homes, we're going to need education, we're going to need recovery, we're going to need mental health, we're going to need to change the fundamental attitudes of our society. And they begin to boldly imagine society otherwise than, you know, how we've inherited it. And I think that's a key feature to radical social transformation.
And are you going to have that same course for students on the inside?
Yes, we've done that.
Because that's what's really incredible. And mm-hmm. as you recall from the documentary you just watched, Ending the Cycle.
Breaking the Cycle.
Mm-hmm. The prison, in the American prison, they asked the prisoners to imagine what could happen in a better prison system. Mm-hmm. But their thoughts were very limited. Because they had not had your course, you know, and the limiting factor, you know, simply was their imaginations at that point. They mm-hmm. had been in walled containment for so long that they couldn't think outside the box, so to speak, mm-hmm. outside the prison. So that would be fascinating with your – to compare you after a class like that where you're opening people's minds to just radically different ways of thinking.
Yeah, because when you're talking about – critical utopian studies, One thing is when you want to boldly imagine society otherwise than what we've inherited, the critical response will say you're utopian. And what they mean by that is that's impossible.
Exactly.
But it's not
utopias
impossible.
Utopias are sort of head the clouds.
Right, exactly. But the social transformations we're talking about aren't impossible. In fact, it's really absurd and it almost seems impossible that we have arrived at the point we've arrived at.
Right.
With this massive concentration of wealth.
100 years ago, this would seem utopian in certain ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, in certain ways. As a woman, you know, if this were 100 years ago or 200 years ago, the kind of freedom I have to do this radio show, the kind of freedom I have to travel on my own, the kind of freedom I have would be utopian, even though it's not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It would just be unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Inconceivable.
That's right. And if you want to imagine society otherwise, you've got to go
talk to people. And that would be an economic
people.
System.
Exactly.
That would be completely transformed.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Into
that's right.
a much more egalitarian one. Did you bring a poem? You had mentioned to me that you had a poem from a student. And as we reach the end of our show tonight, and we do have enough time, certainly, if you have that poem available. I haven't heard it, and it was mentioned in the documentary. And it sounded really fascinating.
Yes. I'm looking at the book right now. I think this is it. We managed to get one book of Flying University poetry published.
How long ago was that?
It came out in 2014.
Mm-hmm. How many students do you have right now in a class? Actually, one question I have, how do you pick the students and how do they apply?
So I always solicit students, outside students. You know, we talked about that a little bit.
Yeah, but the inside ones.
But the inside students are typically selected by Paul McCarthy, the education director.
Okay, so
He's the main, if guys inside are interested in it, they go to him.
Okay.
Some of those guys have been doing it, you know, for a while. They come back.
You had any luck finding the poem? If not, we could talk about something else.
I should have looked at it first, yeah. I'll flip through the book here.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, one thing is this program has been going on so long. Who else is teaching? Do you get teachers from the community or are they all from UAS? Did Robin Walls teach a class?
So I like to bring in guest faculty members. So Robin Walls and I did co-teach a class one semester on the Iliad because we had the one-man show here, right?
Right.
Boston Christopher, right? I played the part.
Boston Christopher,
yes.
Right.
And so that was a fun class. That was actually Robin's idea to do the Iliad. And
mm-hmm.
I've had guest faculty members come in. Like I said, Ernestine Hayes, Lance Twitchell has come in. Emily Wall has come in a couple of times to do creative writing workshops.
Ever thought of having academics from the outside, people who would be qualified to teach a college class?
My teacher, Martin Matusek, Sandra Goodhart, talking about Sandra Goodhart, when he came to visit, he came into the prison. Martin Matusek came into the prison. I do have guest faculty from outside come in.
What about community members who could volunteer to teach a class?
Yeah, I think that would be fun as well. We are a little bit limited by real estate within the prison.
Okay.
You know, I... there used to be a program at Lemon Creek called University Within Walls, I believe is what it was called. I know Ricky Annalino used to teach in that. But I met, this was like late 70s, early 80s, and I met the woman, her name is escaping me right now, but I met her one night at a party, and she was like the director of that program. And she told me that inside the prison right now, where you have all these parole officer offices, that those used to be classrooms. And right now there's only one classroom
and
a writing center. And they have to keep that open for, you know, women inmates and male inmates and library time. Mm-hmm. And there are other classes that are being taught there as well.
What do you hope for? Are you satisfied with where the program is at right now, or would you like to see some improvements?
Well, I am really excited for what seems to be on the horizon right now. Because my colleague, Sarah Stanley at UAF, about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, she started teaching a writing program at Fairbanks Correctional Center called Area 111X. And she reached out to me when our union announced that there would be a pool of research money. And so we applied for a grant together in this academic year. We've been working on bringing higher education to the state's prisons. So in November, we had a think tank in Fairbanks, and then we're going to have this think tank here in Juneau, April 12th through the 14th. If anybody's interested in participating in that, they can get in touch with me through my university contact. And we call that enterprise LION, L-I-O-N, for Learning Inside Out Network. And so LION is comprised of Flying University, Area 111X, and some different things that they're doing at Fairbanks. And what I'm hoping for is a statewide initiative to help bring higher education in the prisons, because we know it works. The data is there. We don't have to be guided by blind ideology of fear and retribution and revenge. We can be human beings, restore the dignity of others, and enable people to transform their lives. Even an associate's degree dramatically reduces the rates of recidivism.
I would imagine. And what a cheap way to do it. Mm-hmm. And also, your program at this moment costs nothing. Wonderful to have a paid coordinator, but right now it is a gift to our prison system to have you teaching and putting your free time in. And our show is now winding down, and I would like to thank Dr. Saul Neely for sharing his knowledge and wisdom about the lives and needs of prisoners. And Saul, your compassion combined with your hard work has really been of great benefit to this community.
Thank you. Not just
to the prison system, but to this community. I'm personally really grateful for that. And otherwise marginalized people who are the other are now receiving college degrees. I mean, they wouldn't even be there probably if it wasn't for the Flying University. And many, many thanks to Shelley Delaney for coming in on a Monday night and being the technician, and for her producing the show and her support for this show. And of course, thanks to all our listeners for tuning in. Please join us next month for another edition of Mind Over Matter on another Monday evening at 7 p.m. Good night, folks.